With the delivery of a budget heavily influenced by Brexit uncertainty, a looming general election and an emergency meeting between Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson yielding seemingly positive steps towards a workable withdrawal agreement, these are strange and testing times for our government. To discuss these challenges, I'm joined in studio by Minister for Finance, Public Expenditure and Reform, Pascal Donoghue. You're very welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, when we spoke the other night on Virgin Media, I asked you the question, what have they to talk about? Surely they're talked out. It seems they did find something to talk about in Cheshire yesterday.
Indeed, and when you were pressing me on your show on Wednesday evening, I was making the point that even though the negotiation will be happening between Brussels and London, and as I'm sure you've already covered, Stephen Barclay, the Brexit Secretary, is meeting Michel Barnier at the moment, you never come across any problem in either private life or public life that gets any easier by not understanding the mind of the other person. And I think what happened yesterday is the Taoiseach and the Prime Minister just had an opportunity to spend time in each other's company again and better understand the views of each other. And I think that's really, really important. And hopefully the meeting and the process today will be positive.
When will you and the Cabinet get a briefing on the shape of this deal, if indeed there is a deal? Because we've seen white smoke being blown away before.
We have indeed. And we have seen many, many different dawns and indeed many different dark moments as well. We have a Cabinet meeting on Tuesday. We meet every Tuesday. I'd anticipate that will be a discussion on Brexit then, like there is at every Brexit meeting.
Every Cabinet meeting is a Brexit meeting.
Indeed, there we go. Well, the slip of tongue proves the point. We discuss it at length every Tuesday, and I'm sure there will be discussion on it then on Tuesday as well. But as we work our way through the day and the morning, particularly in the aftermath of the engagement between Michel Barnier and Stephen Barclay, I think that will give a sense of where things stand.
Now, it will be a selling job. One hopes in this country that the deal, if the Taoiseach agrees to it, it is something that everyone in the Republic can subscribe to. And one presumes that nationalists in the North will give the Taoiseach the backing for whatever concessions he's made. In Northern Ireland, of course, the DUP are a different issue. So that's a job for Boris Johnson to sell, not for the Taoiseach.
Well, one of the great wonders of the Good Friday Agreement is that it managed to come up with an architecture in which both communities in Northern Ireland felt they were part of. And the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach and myself have acknowledged on many occasions our awareness of the variety of different views in Northern Ireland. But what we do need to do is see, with that awareness in mind, is there a possibility of getting to a place that both the British and Irish government feel does work? And I think just to, again, sensitise your listeners, and, you know, you've already acknowledged this. I mean, what happened yesterday was a positive discussion. But the real detailed negotiation and technical work now will begin, and that will be at Brussels.
We pointed out the difficulty with Boris Johnson's deal. It effectively handed a veto to the DUP, because the way the system works in Northern Ireland, both sides have got to agree to any major change, any legislative change. So giving the DUP a veto, the corollary of that is to give the nationalists a veto. So some mechanism has got to be discovered which doesn't give either side a veto.
And the Taoiseach acknowledged this yesterday, in the sense that he indicated that the area of consent and the role of communities in Northern Ireland and Northern Ireland in its entirety is one of the is just a crucial area now for exploration and discussion. The Taoiseach has engaged now on many different occasions with the different traditions in Northern Ireland in relation to where we stand. And we need to look at their views and see how that can be integrated into the work that's underway.
Now, we know there is a natural majority in Northern Ireland for Remain. Mm-hmm. However, that's not an option at the moment. Who knows what will unfold over the coming weeks, but it's not an option at the moment. The idea that Boris Johnson has is that Northern Ireland would stay within the single market, but not the customs union. And the customs union is the thing that gives us the difficulty in terms of trucks and businesses moving back and forth. But the idea was that after 4 years, they could vote their way out of the single market. So if they are to remain without customs tariffs and so on, that means pushing Northern Ireland back into a customs union with the EU. And to get out of it then, maybe they have to vote to get out rather than... Now, that gives a veto to the nationalists. The proposal that we've articulated here is that a referendum instead, and not a 50% plus one vote referendum, but maybe a two-thirds referendum could be used as a mechanism, because without substantial nationalist and unionist support, it won't pass.
Well, look, given that there's discussions actually underway now in Brussels between the British government and the European Union to see if there is a way through this, I think the best thing for me to do is let those discussions continue over the weekend, as opposed to commenting on different options that could be there. I just want to reiterate the understanding of the Irish government that the role of Northern Ireland in this, the views of the different traditions in Northern Ireland are well understood by us. They're well understood by Michel Barnier and the European Union. And I believe the best thing to do, given the sensitivity of all of this, is to just let those negotiations begin.
Now, you did say that what was unfolding as you delivered your budget speech and beyond, immediately beyond, was that you were right to be so prudent. What if it turns out you're wrong and a deal is cut, Britain is out, transition period starts on the 1st of November, and you've got all this money that you haven't spent?
So, Pat, earlier on in the interview, you made the point to me that we've had many other dawns and many other dark moments.
Many of the slips between cup and lip, as
indeed,
the Taoiseach quoted
said yesterday. So we have a long way to go in all of this before that becomes a decision or a point of review. But what I will say, and I said this on Budget Day, and I want to emphasise it again, is I outlined a support framework that is available for dealing with a no-deal Brexit of up to €1.2 billion. But that's money we have to borrow. If we avoid no deal, we won't be borrowing it.
You weren't going to borrow all of it. It was a portion you were going to borrow.
Well, in our figures for Budget Day, the effect of no deal on our economy would take us from a surplus of around 0.4-0.5% back to a fully balanced position, where broadly what we take in would equal what we spend out. What we would then have to do is get into a degree of borrowing to fund the €1.2 billion.
About half of it you'd be borrowing, isn't that?
We would be borrowing more than that. But then even if I was to take your point, and my analysis says that we would be borrowing nearly all or most of it, where we would be in a situation then next year is if we began to use the funding that we have set aside to deal with a no-deal Brexit risk, we would be lowering our surplus. And from my point of view, I'm very, very clear that, number one, you should only do one budget a year. And number two, it's in our interest to have a growing surplus for next year if I look at all of the other issues that could happen if we're able to work our way through this point in the Brexit process.
Now, one of the other pieces of bad news you got immediately after your budget was the OECD proposals on corporation tax. There's one headline which from yesterday's Irish Times would suggest a billion would be lost. Mm-hmm. Some commentators are even less optimistic about that it could be much more than a billion that would no longer come in. I mean, are you planning for that contingency? Because that is, you know, that's not just a one-off Brexit problem. That would be an ongoing corporation tax problem.
That is exactly the case. So how are we dealing with that? The first thing that we've done is I put my stall out in relation to these issues earlier on in the year, where I've laid out a couple of things. The first one is Ireland doesn't get the recognition for the changes that we've made in corporate tax policy. But secondly, within the area of negotiation that you've referred to there, I've laid out Ireland's agenda in relation to where we think is the best landing place for us. But to deal with your question then regarding the potential loss of corporate tax revenue, this goes back to the point I made a few moments ago to you, that if we do get an agreement, the best insulation that we can have to the potential loss of corporate tax revenue in the future is to be running a surplus. So if we do lose tax revenue, we have a surplus in place to cover that. All that being said, I think it will be at least the end of next year before we know if we are facing a risk and how big that risk will be.
Now, there are two elements to this. This is one is where the corporation tax is paid, and there are countries who have their greedy eyes on stuff that is currently repatriated to Ireland, where headquarters of companies are, and the tax is paid here. So that's where the 1 billion or the 1 billion plus mm-hmm. might come in terms of losses. The second thing is this talk about a tax rate change, mm-hmm. that there would be minimum taxes or maximum taxes to be paid as laid down. I always thought that our corporation taxes were a competence for us and us alone.
And that is the case. They are a competence for us from a national sovereignty point of view and within the European Union. And that is the case for nearly all countries that we would be engaging with. But what the OECD are looking to do is establish a principle in relation to the minimum effective tax rate across the world. Indeed, there are kind of signs of this developing in America already, where they have laid out the principle that no American company should be paying less than 13.125% of a tax rate. And
well, we're not too far
globally.
Off that. Nominally, the question is whether there are caveats where companies can use various bits and pieces, whether it's intellectual property or to minimise their tax rate.
And that is why the establishment of the concept of a minimum effective tax rate in global tax policy would be a challenge for Ireland. And that's why I said earlier on in the year that I believe the safer place for us is to be in an environment where tax is levied on the basis of where value is created, as opposed to where services are sold. And that is a better place for exporting countries to be, particularly small exporting countries. But we have a work cut out across the next 18 months in relation to it. But the best thing we can do to mitigate that risk is to be running surpluses.
One of the arguments we had when the French were having a right go at us and trying to interfere in our corporation tax, one of the things that was said in following some analysis was that the effective corporation tax for some French companies in France was around 4 or 5%, even though the headline rate was much higher than that. Has that dawned on the French?
Well, that debate will begin all over again, and our own Controller and Auditor General, who are the independent body to government that look at all our figures and form views and governance and processes, they have released figures that says the gap between our top line rate, which is 12.5%, and the effective rate, which is the 12.5% once you have removed the deductions you can get in our tax code, the gap's really narrow.
How narrow? I mean, we're talking about a couple of points.
So I think the figure they had, they indicate it was just under 11%,
okay,
to the best of my knowledge.
So not a huge difference between the two. Where do we know what it is for France and for other exporting countries?
Well, we will know what these figures are if we get into a debate on it, and we have in the past. But I think the crucial thing will be not only our role in that debate as a country, but then organisations like the OECD and then, of course, the European Union will then be saying to all member states and all countries that it's not just a question of what your published rate is, it's a question of what the effective rate is. And that's terrain we've been in before.
The final question on this is about whether or not we are bound. I mean, we've signed up to the process. Are we bound by the finding? Is it a majority finding or does it have to command unanimity in the OECD?
Well, the OECD is a consent-based organisation and it's always managed to come up with an agreement that most countries are, most if not all countries will agree to. We do not have a veto in the same way we have one in the European Union. But my strong view is that we are better off being in a place that we are able to agree to by consent with whatever the OECD comes up with, because that has been at the heart of how we've managed the last wave of corporate tax change.
All right, moving on to other things. A comment from a listener. Looks like Pascal was never going to pay the €5 rise to social welfare recipients or to old age pensioners, Brexit deal or no deal.
If I had not faced the kind of challenge that I deal with Brexit and that I had coming up with Brexit, there are things that we could have done, would have allowed me to do a fiver, would have allowed me to do stuff from personal taxation.
That sounds like a promise if you're a finance minister this time next year.
Well, look, all my energy at the moment, Pat, has been on finance minister at this point this year and the budget I've just done. But my very strong concern was that I could have made the set of changes in our social welfare code and in our personal tax code that I would have had to undo early next year. I've been through all that before. I don't want it to start again.
Now, we talked the other night about the green agenda and how little really was advanced on the green agenda. One of the listeners here, why not abolish agricultural diesel? Farmers are big users of diesel. Someone else saying have a 20% travel tax, which again would limit the amount of carbon people were burning or else they'd pay through the nose. What do you say to those critics saying you're not green enough?
I'd say to them, listen to all of those who were opposing the move I've made anyway. And where I want to get to is a very significant change that we deliver stage by stage. And I believe I can convince people that a stage by stage approach is the right one to take. In relation to the air travel tax, because this has been put to me indeed by yourself actually on Wednesday night as well, and by others in relation to aviation fuel. Just two things on that. The first one is we're an island country. So those who are arguing we should put a tax on things like that should think carefully in terms of the effect it would have on access to our country. And secondly, the taxation of aviation fuel is not done by national governments. It's done on an EU-wide level. The simple reason for that is if we increase the tax on aviation fuel here in Ireland, should the planes would just go somewhere else to fill up? And I do believe this is an area that's likely to be looked at EU-wide level.
There is talk of Aer Lingus as part of the IAG. IAG group, that they would be using a biojet fuel within the next few years if it works out. I mean, is that an opportunity for Ireland that we could set up a bio-aviation fuel industry here?
Absolutely. And it's not for me and far from me to speak on behalf of the aviation industry in any way. But I do believe companies that are based here in Ireland and associated with Ireland get this, and are you going to see change? So if you look at the change I've made in carbon tax here and what I said that will be €80 per tonne by 2030, please God, if you and I are still here in a few years' time pass, I'd be reasonably certain we'll be seeing a change in the composition of fuel.
One of the points made by Oliver Callan after you left the other night was a thing that's been bothering me, and this is about data centres. They are huge consumers of energy, and a lot of the energy, mm-hmm. as we know in this country, is still carbon generated. They produce relatively little employment once they're built, and we are going to have loads of these all over the countries which will be adding to our carbon footprint. So was this a foolish thing to do to invite these guys in and give them planning permission?
I not at all. I think it was a sensible thing to do.
The virtue for us?
So the virtue for it goes back to the point you made earlier on about corporate taxation and the challenge that we may have in the future in retaining what we have. I believe we would be in a far more solid position if we have three things in place here in Ireland. Number one, the people doing the right kind of work for these companies. Number two, something else on top of that, and that something else on top of it will look like data centre infrastructure. And then number three, a proposition here that encourages the intellectual property and the value to be associated here with Ireland. And for me, the great value in the data centres actually is not the construction of them, isn't the people who are running them. Because Oliver Callan is correct to say actually the people involved in running a data centre are not as great as the people involved in running a factory. But it's part of an overall proposition that makes that international investment more sticky to Ireland and more likely to stay here for long run.
You're saying that the people who are paying for their cloud storage, that money, if the OECD changes the rules, would accrue back to Ireland because this is where the activity is happening and where the sale is happening.
Well, that could be part of us, but I'm just saying that we have companies that have been located here in Ireland now for many decades. It's far more likely they'll be here for many more decades to come if part of the proposition that Ireland is offering is the management and location of data. But just very briefly to your point, I do think we will need to have a debate, though, regarding the trade-offs involved in data centres as well. Because what you're touching on is the fact is they have big energy consequences as well that actually weren't part of the original evaluation we made in these centres. And I think it does need to be more so in the future.
So perhaps they should have been buying carbon credits or planting trees or whatever they should be doing as an offset.
And the other thing as well is they have such big effects on our energy demand here in Ireland and then consequently the kind of energy infrastructure we need in the future. I think this will be an issue you'll hear more public debate about.
Now, when you look at the government in the round, and Brexit has been paralysing was its effect. I mean, housing is still a massive problem. The cost of rent, massive problem. The burgeoning cost of health every year in spite of all the ambitions to balance the budget after giving a huge whack of money last year, you're getting no more. They demanded more, like Oliver Twist. Can I have some more, sir? They are problems that, in a sense, have been the preoccupation of the citizenry, but kind of ignored, it would seem, because of Brexit.
Oh, I'd make the case that they haven't been ignored at all. while accepting the point that, yes, Brexit has absorbed a huge amount of the capacity of the government because of the effect it will have on the future political shape and nature of our country. And I think we've had to give that the attention it deserves. But if I look at where we are in housing, I absolutely appreciate the challenges that your listeners, those renting, still looking to buy, the challenges that we have there. We are going to build, I believe, around 22,000 homes this year. We are beginning to see price moderation occur, which never happened before for us at this point in the economic
or indeed
political
cycle.
I wouldn't say that yet, actually. I think we have had a few months of economic data in relation to house pricing that is significant, but I think we need a bit more to be able to say we're seeing a change. But in either event, we continue to have to drive away at housing supply and making sure we have the right density of apartments here in Ireland.
A final point. It's reiterated again and again, and there was a gentleman in the front row of the audience the other night from Galway who made the point about rural areas, rural dwellers, no public transport, no alternatives to oil heating, can't afford a new car, therefore can't buy electric, house not suitable for a heat pump, carbon tax on top of it. I mean, there's kind of one way of living for the urbans and one way of living for the rurals, and they feel like the poor relation.
And I guess I go back to the early part of our interview where you'll have other people who were saying I did too much in carbon taxation. I didn't do enough in carbon taxation, excuse me. And then those who would feel I did too much. And I'm trying to find a path through to try and deal with those kind of anxieties. What I would say to listeners who are raising an issue like that, this is the reason why I made the decision to go ahead with the National Broadband Plan, and the government did, because I believe that is the long term answer to how we can deepen the economic resilience of all of Ireland. Mm. But the carbon tax, we will use the money that we raise there, the new money that we raise, to begin to even further address the issues that your listener are raising there.
And the last point, there was a mention at the end of your budget speech about dispatching civil servants to the hinterland. One of my listeners the other day said, you know, you wouldn't find even a pair of cows in Dublin 2, where the Department of Agriculture is located, for heaven's sake. It's not decentralisation, because that's a dirty word. So what is it?
I want to just assess where we are with the location of support offices and services in our country at the moment for our civil and public service. We've done great work in it already. Look at the number of people in the Revenue Commissioner in Limerick. Look at the fact that our payroll operations for all public servants, much of that takes place out of Dublin. Given the challenge and need that we have in relation to balanced development across our entire country, I just want to see if there's more that we need to do there. And I think it's worth just acknowledging that this needs to be looked at. And that's what I did on the day.
Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Finance, thank you very much for
joining
us in the studio.